Hi friends, just a reminder that neither Jody nor I are physicians and none of the following should be considered medical advice. Also, in this rapidly developing situation, the best source of information on your community and the regulations and recommendations that apply is your local health department. If you're listening to this in the future, first of all, congratulations on being in the future. Second of all, just know that the beginning of 2020 was a complicated time. Now, please enjoy the theme song by Jonathan Colton. DNA, you're in my heart. DNA. Hi, and welcome to episode 14 of BioBreak, a conversation with your friendly neighborhood biologist. I'm Andy Walsh, and I'm here with my wife, Jody.
Hi there.
And how are we doing this week? Why is it that always gets a laugh?
I think because the end of the week, I'm usually kind of, you know, done because, you know, we've spent time on social media, and it gets a little hard sometimes to process all of the different things that people like to share.
Do you want to say any more about that?
Well, I guess this week I would even go so far as to say the past couple of weeks I've found that it's been extra hard because the numbers have been not going in the direction that I would like them to go.
Yeah, I think other people would also like to be going a different direction.
I think not only just in Western PA, which hasn't been the same as other areas of the country, but it's hearing the mix of, you know, it's fine, we knew there were going to be more cases, but then looking at the for me, because I've learned more about how to look at these numbers, looking at the numbers compared to what some of these numbers were for our area specifically, when we were completely locked down, I find it a little concerning, maybe, but not wanting to be like, oh my gosh, this is crazy, we need to shut everything, because I don't want everything to shut down.
Yeah, so I think maybe some big picture points are good to start with. You know, we personally are not here to try to, you know, nag and police everybody into doing and to call out specific people or specific places or anything. I think the big picture is we want to try to figure out how to help everybody stay healthy and safe, and in all the ways that that manifests, not just not getting this particular virus, but being healthy in general and having.
And I think also managing the narrative of this is all blown out of proportion, kind of, that still seems to be persistent. And, you know, I still personally read different things that, different comments of people wanting to compare it to the flu. And I kind of feel like when there are, you know, tens of thousands of people dying even while the majority of the country is completely locked down, that doesn't really compare to the flu.
Yeah, so I think it's perfectly natural to try to compare it to the flu because we need some kind of frame of reference. People are looking for some way to understand what's going on because it is very different than anything we've experienced. And so because that is an infectious disease that circulates regularly, we all have some kind of context for it. And because there is some similarity in the presentation of symptoms, although not exact correspondence, the flu presents itself as a natural point of comparison. And that's fine. I think we just have to understand that there are some significant differences from the flu, as well as some of those similarities of symptoms and presentation. You know, and some of those differences include the fact that no one had immunity to this virus prior to, you know, 2020, or, you know, maybe very early or very late 2019 were some of the first cases. So prior to that, no one had been exposed to this virus and had immunity. The symptoms are different. In particular, the shortness of breath and the low blood oxygen levels, the hypoxia. That is a symptom that is seems to be more common with this coronavirus and happens with the flu. By contrast, things like sore throats are less common, although not unheard of or impossible with this coronavirus, where it's more common with the flu.
The blood clot seems to be very different.
Right, and then when you get into the more severe illness, you see there's severe illness in more young people than we see with the flu. There's a wider range of presentations of severe illness, from things like this pneumonia and cytokine storms to things like blood clots that don't seem to be respiratory at all. And in some cases, for some people, blood clots or the consequences of blood clots like a stroke are their very first presentation of the illness. They prior had no idea that they had been infected or even exposed. And so that is very different from the flu. And the age in which those severe illnesses are happening is different from the flu. We have a flu season every year. We don't see the same kinds of large clusters of outbreaks and deaths in nursing homes that we've been seeing with, if that was happening every year on this kind of scale, we would have some sense of that, right? And we would be doing different things with nursing homes if that were really the case. I'm not saying that it's never happened. Certainly, nursing homes are an area of concern for all kinds of clusters of infections, not just respiratory illnesses, because of the nature of the setting. That you have a lot of people in the same place who are already in poor health.
A lot of at-risk people.
Right, because that's why they're in the nursing home to begin with, is that they have some health needs. And so they're a point of concern for many kinds of infections, including bacterial infections and things that we don't see out in natural settings.
Just thinking, even through the course of a normal flu season, people can still go in and visit their relatives in nursing homes and rehabilitation facilities. And that's not the case, I think, for most areas. I think they're still really limiting.
Yeah, I think we're at a point where now where it varies a little bit. And so obviously, if you're thinking about visiting someone, check with the local places and check with the nursing home itself. They'll know what is and isn't required of them. And then what their local, what their facility specific policies are that may be more stringent than what's allowed by law or by the health department. But I have been hearing that some places are allowing some forms of visits, at least, or have allowed that, and that may have already been reversed again. And, there's a lot that's changing on an ongoing basis, and so that's why it's important to be aware of what's happening. If you need to make these decisions, if you don't know anyone in nursing home, you're planning on visiting nursing home, you don't need to keep tabs of that particular dimension of it. But
the short story is that while it's helpful to kind of look at this, through the framework of the flu, it's not really, we're not dealing with just a flu.
Yeah, taking the same approach that we take to the seasonal flu and applying it to this is going to have very different results. Because the biology and the clinical presentation of the virus is different. And again, because nobody had immunity to that, and most people still don't have any sort of immunity because they have no exposure to it. And so we can very quickly get to high levels of numbers of people sick if we just let transmission of the virus persist unmitigated and unhindered.
So maybe we should go and start talking about what some of these numbers have been lately and kind of get some perspective.
Yeah, so, I think you wanted to talk a little bit about, the concept of herd immunity and what that...
That's been another thing that I've seen pop up, is that, since there's so many more and it's young people getting infected, where we'll be closer to herd immunity. The number that I heard is that we're still only at maybe about 10% of the population exposed to it.
Right. So if you look at the total number of cases, we're still, those are people who have gotten sick enough to get tested and tested positive, or were sick enough and had other indicators to be listed as a probable case. So some kind of epidemiological connection to a known case or cluster of cases, the right symptoms, or possibly the right symptoms and an antibody test that indicated exposure at some point to be listed as a probable case. But most of the cases that are listed in various places are confirmed cases, meaning that they had a positive virus test that detected the virus itself in their system, whether or not they were symptomatic. And so the number of those in the United States is still just shy of 3 million, which is a little bit less than 1% of the United States population. So to say that, 10% of the population has been exposed means you're estimating that, there's about 1 out of every 10 people who gets exposed gets sick enough to get medical attention. That's a pretty high ratio, not unprecedented, not uncommon, based in some of these, and it has some basis in these seroprevalence tests or surveys where they go out and they give the antibody test to a large number of people and then look at what fraction of them have antibodies to the virus. It's based on some amount of modeling and estimation and forecast and that sort of thing. And so there's a big uncertainty about that number in that it could be a lot less than the 20 or 30 million of people being exposed. That would mean that about 10% of the United States exposed. It seems unlikely that it's a lot more than that, given the seroprevalence results, given other things, given the modeling, given just the way that we're seeing the virus continue to spread and we're seeing these upsurges in cases. There was a notion, I think, at one point in certain circles that maybe, after that first peak and coming down again, that just a whole lot more people, and as we heard more about asymptomatic cases or whatever, that the virus had just been circulating a lot more widely than we thought, mm-hmm. and that we were seeing, we weren't going to see another resurgence because a lot more people had immunity than we thought. But then we're seeing, these flare-ups in places like Florida and Arizona where, it's tens of thousands of new cases a day. It's clearly not consistent with one of these scenarios in which most of the people had already been exposed. Mm-hmm. It's more consistent with a scenario in which only, 5 or 10% of the population had already been exposed. And so it's still spreading quite extensively or still has the potential to spread quite extensively. So the numbers, so let's call it, 10% just as, that's an estimate that's been put out there that I think, has some merit to it, but understanding that there's going to be some uncertainty on that in either direction. And in particular, there's a potential, based on the observed number of cases for it to be significantly lower. What you need for herd immunity depends on how infectious the virus is and how robust the immune response to it is. From what we know of how infectious this particular virus is, which we express in that R0 that we talked about, the reproductive number, how many new cases you get when one infectious person is introduced to a completely naive population. That's been estimated around 2 to 3. I've seen some estimates put it a little bit higher, maybe 4 or 5. And that's kind of partly based on the fact that there seems to be some clustering of spread that relative to the flu, even this virus has a little bit more of a tendency to either not spread or to spread to a large number of people all at once. And that probably has a lot to do with how people are gathering. Mm-hmm. But, again, human behavior was the same, is the same whether you have the flu virus or the coronavirus.
But it is pretty fascinating. Like I know of somebody I'm connected with online where, they're out of the family, 3 of them got it and 1 of them didn't. They're all in the same house and trying to isolate, but that is, when you're quarantined in a house, there's very little that you can do to really kind of isolate. So it's to me, I find it fascinating and a little
scary. And it is a big, it's fascinating to a lot of scientists, and one of the areas that people are actively studying is just trying to understand why this virus seems to come in clusters a little bit more than some other viruses, even like the flu. And there are viruses even less prone to clustering than the flu. Yeah, just that tendency that a person, you know, a person may in a home may be infected and may not infect anybody else. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that we should behave as if we're not going to spread it if we are sick or we think we're sick or anything like that, or that the people around us are sick, right? Because we don't know which, we don't know what are the circumstances that cause some people to spread and not and not other people to spread. So we don't want to just assume that it's not going to spread because we're not at a, you know, we're not in a context where there's a potential for a big cluster. There's still plenty of examples of it spreading from just one person to another person in a household context or in a community setting where there, you know, there's not a lot of
Yeah. I mean, how, you know, the story of how, you know, it even entered this family was a very, like, just random kind of chance thing. And so, yeah, it's, it seems like every possibility where this virus can kind of really, like, throw you for a loop, it does, kind of.
You know, it, there, we're still learning about it, and it is still a very different virus than the ones that we're familiar with, like the flu or the measles or whatever. It is most similar to the SARS virus that emerged in 2003. That's the closest connection that we have among things that that have caused human disease on any kind of scale. It has some similarity to viruses that cause colds. But yeah, it's very, very different biologically from the flu virus or the measles virus or anything like that. And so, yeah, so we still have a lot to learn about it. And so, yeah, there are still going to be things that will be new information. And of course, you know, when you, when you're gathering together data and stories and scenarios and incidences from 7 to 8 billion people around the world, you're going to get a lot of, you know, unusual combinations of events and unlikely scenarios and so forth. And we're just, you know, there's a lot of scrutiny on this virus right now. And so we're noticing all kinds of things that that we might not notice in a different kind of setting in a virus that didn't cause quite as severe an illness.
So what kind of numbers will we be looking at for, like, herd immunity?
Yeah, right. So getting back to that. So that's, so, you know, because of that clustering, that can make it a little bit harder to assign a single R0 to this virus. But let's take the, you know, 2 to 3 estimate. That's a, you can use that to figure out what percentage of the population needs to be immune to get herd immunity. And for, if it's in that 2 to 3 range, you're talking about like 60 to 70% of the population. That's, I think I've seen 70% quoted most widely, but, you know, some people will say 60%. And again, all these things should come with some kind of range, right? No, nobody's that certain about it. But let's say for, you know, again, let's call it 2/3, right? Somewhere between 60 and 70%. 2/3 makes the math easy because there are 330 million people in the United States, roughly. And so what that, again, what that herd immunity means is that there's now enough people around who are immune to the virus who that if they get exposed, they can't get infected. And so then they therefore can't infect other people, that the chances of somebody who is infected and infectious bumping into a susceptible person is that much lower. And so the virus stops spreading. Doesn't mean it stops, you know, instantly, but it means that it's going to decline to the point where it's no longer circulating. And so to get to that four, you know, assuming our not of 2 to 3, assuming that herd immunity level is about 2/3, that means 220 million people in the United States need to get exposed to this virus. And again, currently, we know of just shy of 3 million who are confirmed or probable cases. And we estimate that maybe upwards of 30 million people have been exposed. And so we're still, you know, almost 200 million people away from reaching that herd immunity on a national scale. Mm-hmm. Of course, herd immunity on a national scale isn't necessarily, you know, the virus isn't necessarily spreading on a national scale. It's spreading locally from person to person. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, New York City is obviously has a higher number of people that have already been exposed. When they did a seroprevalence survey a while back, it was already at 20%. Presumably it's higher than that now, although they've significantly curtailed the spread of the virus in New York City. But it's still presumably a little bit higher than that, at least. And so in different parts of the country, you could have herd immunity sooner or later, and depending on how much people are moving around between those different parts of the country matters. But yeah, but generally, you know, if we're going to talk on a national scale, we're still talking about 200 million people. 200 million.
That's a lot of people.
Would need to get exposed. And that is all assuming that immunity to this virus is strong enough to prevent infection and transmission and last long enough that by the time we get to those 200 million people, that the, you know, the first 30 million still have enough immunity to be relevant.
That's like the trickiness of this, is that we still only know how long immunity lasts based off of the first people who got it.
Right.
And we survived.
Right. We don't know how long immunity to this virus lasts. And so that's why, you know, the ideal scenario would be to achieve herd immunity through mass vaccination rather than through through everybody getting exposed. Because
also thinking about 200 million people getting sick, I mean, granted it's not all at once, but we still don't know how to necessarily predict the severity of...
For any given person, we don't know. We know that there are certain risk factors, but that doesn't mean that there aren't young, healthy people who don't fit any of the risk categories who aren't getting very seriously ill. And even though many more of them are recovering, and in general, the story, you know, is that the treatment seems to be doing, you know, better, a better understanding of what is and isn't effective for treating these patients. And so the mortality rate has been trending downwards in the United States. And that may be partly also because of a shift in demographics of who is getting infected. But that, you know, that's all a good thing. Like, mm-hmm. I certainly hope that that continues to be the case. At the same time, we know that if a lot more people get sick, it's a lot more people who are at risk of getting severe illness and more people who are at risk of dying from it. Mm-hmm. And even with better treatment and so forth, those risks are still there. And, you know, if we really start to tax the healthcare system, then those risks go up because there's just not enough ventilators and not enough drugs and not enough physicians to go around to treat all the people all at once.
There have been stories of them potentially starting needing to ration care out in Arizona. That was one of the stories that I was picking up on the news. I don't know what exactly that would look like, but that just the idea that they're thinking that they're either getting to that point is very frightening.
Yeah, and you know, that doesn't mean that all hope is lost, and you know, the more we can do to mitigate transmission, the less likely those kinds of scenarios are going to happen. But we haven't completely eliminated the possibility of those scenarios. You know, to get to if transmission of a virus that has an R naught of 2 to 3 is just left to go unchecked, and we try to get to herd immunity as quickly as possible, try to get those 200 million people, you know, immune as quickly as possible. At some point, you're talking about if you look at these, you know, SIR models that we've talked about in the past, you know, you're talking about going through a phase where maybe 10%, 15%. It depends exactly on what R0 is. It depends on exactly on how how uniform that across the country the transmission is, which we know it's unlikely because you know it hasn't been to this point. But you know, just kind of a very naive modeling, and I'm not saying this is what is going to happen.
No,
saying that, you know, if you take a fairly basic model and look at the behavior of it, you go through a stage where 10-15% of the total population is infected at the same time. Doesn't mean all those people are going to die. Obviously, most of them are going to recover. But you know, think about even just 10% of the country. One out of every 10 people
even
is
if
sick.
Even if 10-15% of the people in the country just taking a sick day from work, like
right,
and that's going to have a significant impact, I would imagine.
Right, and it's unlikely to be just one sick day. You know, even for people who are ultimately recovering from this illness, you know, the amount of time that they're spending ill and needing to rest and, you know, stay away from work and stay away from people and all that kind of stuff is, you know, on the order of days and in some cases weeks. And again, that factors into how long that period is. If a virus that spreads more quickly but also resolves more quickly You might have a period of time where there's like 50% of people are sick, but it is only like one day,
mm-hmm.
right? And again, in a very simplified, model that probably wouldn't cover, couldn't possibly have that kind of synchronicity for an entire country, mm-hmm. But of 300 and some odd million people. But even if you're talking about, you know, different cities going through that at different times, right? If you think about even just in your city, 10% of the people are sick for a few days. And then that's not like that's the only thing that happens, right?
Yeah.
Then another 10, maybe another 10% isn't all sick at the same time, but it's before and after and so forth. Right? You're talking about an extended period of time of weeks and months where a noticeable fraction of people are at the very least, unable to do their jobs at 100% capacity. And, for those jobs that require them to show up in person, they're not able to show up because of the risk of transmission. And we also don't have the complete ability to pick and choose who that 60 to 70% is as much as we would like to. And yes, in an ideal scenario, if we could identify the 60 to 70% of the U.S. population that wouldn't have severe illness and would eventually recover and be just fine and all of that, if we could pick that 70% to get infected and spread it out so that it was done in such a way that that we didn't have these crunches of employment and everybody having to be sick at once, then yes, that would be one way to get to herd immunity and to try to check the spread of the virus. But it's really hard to pick and choose that 60-70%, especially because we don't have perfect knowledge about who would be at risk and who wouldn't be at risk for severe illness, and because we can't completely isolate the people who are at risk from the people who aren't at risk, mm-hmm. In high risk, and there's nobody who's at zero risk. And we don't have, we don't have complete control over human behavior and who gets infected and when. But to some degree, that is what we're trying to accomplish with these mitigation measures, right? Is to spread it out, because if we don't want to let it happen all at once, trying to get there as quickly as possible without a vaccine does have its own set of problems. So, the next best thing, if we don't think that we're ever going to get a vaccine or that it's going to take a really long time, the next best thing is to try to spread it out so that, yes, we do get to herd immunity, but not by passing through that time of everybody being, so many people being sick all at once.
Yeah, that was, I feel like that was, it was communicated. I don't know how effectively it was communicated when we first started and everybody was shutting things down. It wasn't so that none of the experts really felt that by shutting it down, we were going to completely get everybody sick who was well, and then the disease would die off because it wouldn't be able to transmit to any hosts. The experts knew that wasn't really going to happen because it's so easily transmissible. So it was more about trying to, as they said, slow the spread to the point where we can kind of, have the resources to take care of people without being completely overwhelmed. And then we started opening everything back up, and I hope we don't have to shut everything down again, I guess.
Yeah, time will tell what the what measures are taken. I think, locally, we haven't seen the sort of explosive spread yet that would suggest that, everything needs to, go back to zero again, go back to the tightest restrictions. But it probably does mean we need to turn the knobs and the dials a little bit more to figure out what the right combination of activities is to keep the spread low.
I think that, just to kind of interject a little bit, I think that is kind of the message that, I don't know if it's being communicated in the best way. It's not that, the scientists and public health experts are changing their mind about everything. It's more, it really is like what you're saying. It's like adjusting the dials,
Right.
I don't know if it's comparable to cooking and you're adjusting the burner to the right temperature, that you're getting things cooked but not burning things. I don't know. Trying to think metaphorically.
Yeah, I understand. You know, I think there's a couple of things there. I think, you know, partly, you know, the policy decisions, the decisions about what kind of restrictions to implement and not implement at any given time are not purely, you know, public health decisions. They are also political decisions, meaning that, you know, government leaders are taking into account other things like economic needs and so forth. And that's, that is what it is. That is how these things are going to work. And so, you know, so that's part of why, you know, the tension, or maybe not tension, but the dynamic of different interests and different viewpoints and different concerns factoring into the ultimate decisions that are made. And so, yeah, so in that respect, it's not necessarily that anybody is changing, you know, the science is changing or what have you. It's just that we're trying to take into account all the different factors, including the data from the science. And then, yes, there also is, there's a feedback mechanism of, we have some uncertainty about which activities can be done safely and which ones don't. And also, we have an even greater uncertainty about how people are actually going to behave if we allow certain activities and or not allow certain activities, right? So, you know, we have a pretty good sense of which things are more or less risky. But then it's a question of how will people behave to keep the risk low or high or what have you in those particular situations. And so, yeah, so I think that's where some of that feedback is coming in, and, you know, and that metaphor of kind of adjusting knobs and dials is, yeah, you're getting some information back in the form of, are cases going up or not, to know, yeah, these activities, for whatever reason, either the activity itself wasn't quite as safe as we thought, or our ability to perform it in a safe way was not as great as we thought, or whatever, so we need to dial back a little bit. You know, and of course, you know, we're talking about feedback in the form of cases increasing, but we don't have perfect information either on, well, what specific things are going to increase, because a lot of things are changing all at once. Mm-hmm. You know, just looking at locally, the shift from red to yellow to green also overlapped with a shift to warmer weather, also overlapped with people being more inclined to go on vacation to other parts of the country where the infection rates were different. And so that's several variables now that you're trying to figure out from one source of feedback, what are the most important things. And we can get some more detailed information by looking at doing epidemiological investigations of those cases and saying, well, where were these people exposed? What do they have in common? You know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so it's not exactly just one source of feedback, mm-hmm. but it's still, you know, there are confounding and overlapping factors that we may not be able to completely isolate.
Well, and there's also some amount of, you know, predicting people's behaviors. I know, you know, this past week when the locally they decided to take a break from having restaurants serve alcohol. And having bars serve alcohol. And part of that was because it was becoming clear that there were some, you know, local areas of the city that were starting to be hotspots of cases. And what I was hearing people's complaints was like, why don't you shut down those specific areas and not the whole county? But I kind of wonder if they really were thinking through, well, if I just can't go to a bar and have alcohol in this part of town, well, I'll just drive to this part of town and go to this one. And so then it just ends up kind of perpetuating through the county instead of really kind of slowing it down, it seems. And so that's where I kind of felt like they're trying to anticipate some of the people's choices that they're going to make with opening and closing and...
Right. I mean, we know that there are, we know that one aspect of human behavior is that they'll try to find an alternative to a desired or necessary activity or behavior. And so, yeah, if you adjust over here, it'll shift over there. That you can see in a wide range of different kinds of behaviors and activities and so forth. There's also an element of, just because it was this particular bar this time doesn't mean that it can't be another one another time, right? It may not have anything to do with what was going on at that specific bar. It just means that that happened to be the one where somebody walked in who was already infected. And next week it might be a different bar. There's also an element of it might just happen to have been bars this time, but next time it might be a different kind of gathering of people, right? And so that's where there needs to be some element of, we can't just react to what has already happened. We have to look at the kinds of things that have happened and what other things are similar to that. And so obviously the most similar thing is, well, if it was at this specific bar, the most similar thing is other kinds of bars. But, you know, restaurants serving alcohol, other kinds of, you know, places, you know, and I think one, you know, dimension there is the inability to wear a mask, you know, because of the, you know, you're drinking, you're eating. And so that really limits your ability to wear a mask. And that may be.
And there's another public health issue if you're just like chugging your drink and then putting your mask back on and then you go and chug your next.
Possibly. Yeah.
Just being silly.
Yeah. And so that, so, you know, that may be the critical factor there. It's not so much the alcohol as the interaction with the ability to wear a mask when you're inside in close quarters with other people. And, you know, and I'm not in these situations, so I don't know exactly what all the factors are. Just kind of going by in general, what, you know, what that environment, would be like. But yeah, so once cases are spreading, you can't just say, well, we have to stop the thing that already happened, because now you've got a different group of people who are infected than the people who generated those clusters. And so they may be engaged in different kinds of behaviors and different kinds of activities. And they have different social networks and different interaction networks of connections that may be related to their place of employment or their neighborhood or whatever. So only reacting to whatever the thing was that was the last cluster is probably not adequate. Certainly, obviously, you don't want to ignore what you know about the clusters that have happened and just say, well, that's not going to happen again. Like, of course, it could still happen again in those kinds of settings as well. But you have to keep in mind that it's a dynamic system that's always changing and evolving. And so just applying a control for what has already happened may not cover everything that can happen in the future.
So we talked about herd immunity. We talked about some numbers. How do we think the rest of the summer is going to go? are you still looking at this scientifically? And I know everything's kind of measured. Are you looking at the next few weeks feeling like, I don't know what's going to happen? Or are you looking at more like, no, we're adjusting, we're, you know, things went up and now we're going to kind of pull back and bring things down? Or.
Yeah, I think that it is important to look at this as a problem solving activity. Again, that big picture of the goal that we're trying to get is to keep as many people healthy and safe as possible and to meet as many people's basic needs as possible, including getting them food and getting them mental health care and so forth, in addition to keeping them safe from this particular viral infection.
Yeah, I think just to kind of, you know, pause there for a minute, I think because I've had conversations with you as somebody who works in public health, what exactly public health really encompasses. It's not just focused on tracking diseases. You're focused on so many broad things that are connected to, and part of that is being able to meet those basic needs of, you know, working and food and mental health. And
yeah, I mean, so if we take a step back for a minute, right? Infectious disease department of your local public health department and your state public health department was not necessarily the biggest part of that public health department, not necessarily the most well-funded. And I'm not really in a position to talk about, you know, funding and so forth and funding priorities and all of that. But just, you know, for perspective, I'm reasonably confident that the infectious disease division was not the biggest and the most well-funded in most state health departments. It may vary by county and state and what have you. But we're not talking about, oh, this is the, you know, this is the cash cow or whatever of the public health department. You know, infectious diseases, you know, through vaccination, through campaigns to control mosquitoes for some diseases, through campaigns of just general hygiene and cleanliness and all that, and cleaning up both environmental sources of things and our own personal hygiene. We've done a lot of good work to reduce the disease burden of infectious diseases in this country over the past 100 years. And so, yeah, that hasn't necessarily been the highest priority or the most visible thing or what have you. Public health spans a lot of different dimensions of health, like you mentioned. And so all of that, you know, is at work. And maybe there's even an element of, you know, we could have been a little bit better prepared for this because we weren't as focused on infectious diseases as were some of the other things. Not that the other things aren't important, and they're still needed, right? That, you know, this particular moment that we find ourselves in is not just an infectious disease public health concern. It is also a mental health public health concern. It is also a general nutrition and wellness, public health concern. It is a chronic disease public health concern, partly because chronic diseases are one of the risk factors. Some chronic diseases are among the risk factors for more severe viral infection. So, you know, so many of the dimensions of public health kind of intersect in this moment, as they do in so many things, right? That's being looked at, that has been looked at in the past prior to this, and it was continuing to be taken into consideration, and people are continuing to look at how to support not just the prevention of infection of this particular virus, but how to support general health and well-being of our communities and the public. That is the goal. And so we need to be looking at this, again, as a problem-solving challenge to how do we do that. And economic resources and economic solutions are going to be part of that. Making sure that people have the money that they need to buy the food that they need and to buy, you know, to pay for healthcare and all that. Those are all important things. It may look a little bit different than it normally does, right? But, you know, that is going to be a part of it. But the economics can only buy so much health, right? You focusing purely on an economic solution isn't going to prevent the spread of the virus. But making sure that our communities are healthy and keeping down the spread of the virus will help to keep the economy healthy as well, because then people can go to work. Like I was saying, you know, you're not going to have these situations where lots and lots of people are unable to work for an extended period of time. And so that, you know, the health of the community contributes to the health of the economy. Just kind of looking at it as this is our current situation. This is what the numbers look like currently. It's not completely dire. It's not we're just on rails towards a herd immunity situation. There's nothing that can be done differently, and that's our best, you know, thing to hope for. No, I don't think it will ever be out of our control. You know, human behavior is still the biggest variable in all of this. And so that means we have a lot of control over what happens, and we have a lot of opportunity to improve and to benefit the health of our neighbors and friends and family and communities by the choices that we make. Both individually and the choices that we make on a policy level and collectively. And by doing things, you know, to be, you know, creative solutions to how do we look in and make our neighbors and visit people in ways that are maybe virtual or in ways that are, you know, physically separated or what have you. But, you know, keeping up on all these things.
This is definitely an opportunity for people to really put into practice. I know, just because we have school-age children, we've heard over the years about how they're trying to instill creative problem solving and really teach, like, this is where we all have to, like, practice this. And how do we make the things that we want to do, how do we really make them so that we can still do them, but do them in a way that keeps everybody safe?
Right. And, you know, and to continue to innovate on things like vaccines and drugs. And also to innovate on things like, I was reading something about, you know, they're trying to develop clothing that has been, or fabric that has been treated in a certain way that when it gets wet, and in very small amounts, such as, you know, the microscopic droplets that you emit when you're talking or coughing or whatever, that little bit of moisture generates a little bit of electrical current that can potentially disable or disrupt the virus so that it's no longer infectious, right? So that as soon as I cough on that mask, not only is that mask or that gown or whatever kind of holding on to the virus particles, it's actually sterilizing them.
Great.
That's an interesting, you know, technological innovation and a clever thing to try to help, you know, and more of that.
Yeah, I was seeing something even like simpler, just for, I was looking at they're trying to develop some kind of see-through cloth. So it's not plastic, but there's a bit of, but it's also not mesh. So like there's something where it's a barrier, but you can still see for people who rely on sign language, you can't hear, but need to like read lips. And, you know, personally as a photographer, it's really hard to kind of get smiles. I mean, the best way you get smiles from people is by, you know, smiling at them and making silly faces. And so the working with a mask has been really challenging, but like seeing that kind of an innovation too.
Yeah. Or the different, you know, face shields and different things that, you know, that face-to-face connection with a person is important. How do we do that in a way that is safe? Yeah, all of these, you know, clever problem-solving solutions. And yeah, you know, maybe they won't all scale up and maybe, you know, we won't have time to do them all or whatever, but the positivity and the innovation that generates and the emphasis that puts on, we have some control, you know, perfect control, but we have some control over our situation. We have some ability to impact it positively. Let's just keep working on that and focusing on that instead of we're just kind of doomed to whatever the fates may have for us, for good or for ill. And you know, one other note, you know, we had another positive vaccine trial was published in the past week or so. Another one of these RNA vaccines. There's actually, apparently there's four different variants that this company has come up with, and they published results on one of them. It's a phase one trial, so we don't know if it's effective in preventing infection, but we know that it's effective at generating the kind of immune response that we want, the kind of antibodies in these patients or in these recipients of the vaccine that we want to see, and that it didn't cause side effects outside of what we would normally expect for vaccination.
I know you don't know for sure, but do you have like any kind of idea of like an approximation of when we might start hearing like phase two?
Yeah, I don't know what the timetable is for the phase two trial. So this one is obviously going to be going on to phase two. We talked about another vaccine candidate, the Moderna vaccine candidate, that is, you know, is in phase two. There's some other things that are maybe in sort of a hybrid phases, and again, in different parts of the world, the phases might look a little bit differently, or the exact procedures might look a little bit differently. But yeah, I don't have the other thing. I know that the Oxford they had a vaccine candidate in the UK that they were talking about having phase three type clinical trial results by the end of October. That was when they announced the start of what they were doing. I don't know if they're still on track for that. But yeah, it's probably going to be, you know, I would guess probably towards the end of the summer, we'll start to be hearing, just knowing the time, you know, it takes weeks, right? They're looking at the antibody levels in these patients on day like 45 post-injection. Well, you think about it, that means it takes 45 days to do that kind of study.
So that's probably like the biggest factor in these vaccine developments is just the waiting for the results.
Yeah, there are definitely things that we can do to speed them up. One of the things that we can't speed up is how fast the human body generates an immune response to generates an adaptive immune response to a pathogen or to a vaccine. And so that does put a limit on how quickly we can go through these trials. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're trying to do everything around that, you know, making sure
all the paperwork and
making sure stuff, that when phase one is done, we're ready to go into phase two. They're already talking about, you know, one of the things that they said in the publication of these research, talking about a phase one trial, they're like, because these results are positive enough that we should start manufacturing this vaccine just in case it works.
Yeah.
Still a long ways away. Still a lot of questions to be answered till we get that point, but we're going to put our money where our mouth is and try to get, you know, try to make sure that this is ready as it can be. Yeah.
It's definitely, I mean, you know, the unprecedented has become such an overused word, but it's really amazing to see all of the people, like, really rallying. So, maybe we wrap up.
That sounds good.
We've talked quite a bit.
We have. I think we've forgotten in the past few episodes to remind people that we have an email address and a Twitter and all of that. So you can email us at biobreakpod@gmail.com. We'd be happy to hear any questions or things, feedback. If you like things that we're doing, you can tell us that too.
Oh, we like that.
Yeah. Yeah, if you have questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
We're on Facebook, BioBreak.
Yep.
On Facebook.
And at BioBreakPod on Twitter. And we look forward to hearing
from you.
And
if you have anything beyond coronavirus that you would like to, you have questions about or want to hear us talk about.
Even bigger picture, we would eventually like to have a biology podcast about everything but the coronavirus. So by all means, if you have topics, a book that you read, a news article that you read, or just like a topic that you want to hear more about.
Something weird growing in my refrigerator, what could that be?
Sure. Any kind of biology questions. Yeah. So we look forward to hearing about what you have in your fridge.